Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Cynthia Joyce, editor of Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina. Also, Tony Dunbar talks about his new mystery, Night Watchman. Cynthia Joyce has edited one of my favorite Katrina books this season, Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina, a fine collection of those urgent and immediate messages online. She begins in 2005 and goes forward to 2007, tracking the virtual community. Cynthia has been a writer, editor, and web producer for more than 15 years, and she now teaches at Ole Miss. Cynthia Joyce, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So you were living in New Orleans post-Katrina, weren't you?
Yeah. I was there for 2+ years after Katrina, and I finally, at the end of 2007, I was starting to realize that there was the influx of all the kind of new, young energy, a lot of the kind of volunteers and folks coming in and falling in love with the city and wanting to help, and I was kind of starting to see myself as part of the problem, not part of the solution. I was really kind of, I think, disaster wary at that point and depressed, you know. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I was worn out. And so I think I kind of saw the signal for myself, and I heard myself talking to people and was sort of embarrassed when I would talk to people who were coming in and who were so young and enthusiastic, and not just young people either, but people who just were, who weren't sort of worn out. And I felt kind of ashamed. I was like, I'm not a hero in this story. You know, there was a lot of heroes in the Katrina story, and I was very kind of aware of not being one of them.
So what was the impetus for this book?
For the past several years, I've taught classes. I've actually brought a group of journalism students down to New Orleans for a media class. And, you know, I was finding myself sort of increasingly pointing to things that weren't there any longer when I was trying to answer questions about Katrina or explain the Katrina story. And that was happening very much in the physical landscape. I was pointing to the lower Ninth Ward, and we were looking at the Make It Right houses. We weren't seeing what was no longer there. Or I would point to, you know, I'd say this used to be cypress swamps. This used to be, you know, wetlands. Now it's just water. And it was getting harder and harder to kind of explain to students what it was like prior to that. Like, my source text of that time was very much online. Like, I lived and worked on the web and followed a lot of people online. And during the storm especially, that was where, you know, I reconnected with people. And so I kind of went online to sort of try to remember what it felt like at that time. And then was alarmed to discover that even on the internet, a lot of that stuff had eroded.
I know. I thought that was so interesting, because you do think that people put this stuff online and it's there forever, but it's really not.
Yeah, that is definitely the drumbeat of, you know, a million high school guidance counselors, right? That don't put that stuff out there because it's never going away.
Yeah.
And we do. Increasingly, we treat the internet like it's our personal time capsule. I mean, and we're encouraged to think about it that way. And we just kind of assume that there's going to be this record that's kept, and we put more and more of ourselves online all the time. And, you know, during Katrina especially, that was an important thing to be able to do, to be able to, you know, when the material world was being washed away, it was sort of like, this will be a safe place to keep all this while my life is in flux.
Now, you've included some really well-known writers and bloggers in this book, and of course, everybody talks about post-Katrina blogging. They talk about Ashley Morris.
Yeah, there were a lot of amazing writers. I mean, there's a lot of different little cabals of bloggers. You know, there are people who very much were identified with that title and politicized by that title, too. I mean, I think they very much saw themselves as having an active role in kind of like this changing media landscape. And that was, you know, a lot of those folks were the rising tide originators and did amazing work. You know, they really were truly like these citizen watchdogs. And that completely had a, you know, changed the direction of a lot of things that were going on, I think, at the time. But then there were a lot of people, too, who just were looking for an outlet or a place, you know, a lot of people who were writing without any expectation of an audience whatsoever. They were maybe writing, you know, open to the idea of it, but certainly not looking for it, certainly not trying to sort of, you know, leverage their personal brand is sort of the way we talk about that stuff today. It was a really different time on the web. The ethos was very different. I think there were a lot of people who were using it as their kind of personal but yet public diary.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a good mix. There's a mix of folks who were bloggers, like capital B bloggers. I think there were a lot of journalists who were then kind of blogging on the side, and that's a really interesting phenomenon to me as well. I don't think today people would get away with that as much. You know, you can't say one thing either on air and for the newspaper that you work for and then on your personal blog
right.
say something that would compromise that and not be found out within 5 minutes. But, you know, the web was still sort of this intimate space, I think, even just 10 years ago. I think there was a sense that you could kind of have your own little hidey hole, and that even though it was public, it still felt personal. It still felt you could have some ownership. And you saw that a lot, especially there's two bloggers in particular, Mike Keller and Josh Norman, who are at the Biloxi Sun-Herald. And, you know, they were part of the Pulitzer-winning team and writing all this amazing stuff for the paper. But then at night, they would come home and write on their blogs about the difficulty of reporting on this stuff and how, you know, they were getting annoyed with everybody calling in and making sure that the dolphins were okay or that the dogs were okay, and how offensive they found that people weren't more concerned about the actual citizens.
Right.
And that's not something that would make it into, you know, a daily report. The fact that they were doing that sort of two different sides of it, I think, is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I look at the writers of the NOLA Fugees, writers like Bill Lofelm, Deborah Cotton, Dan Baum, Chef Chris DeBar. I mean, it's such a broad, broad cross-section. So how did you choose? Because we all know you could have made this book 10 times as long. So what was your focus when you were trying to choose individual entries?
You know, when I started, I didn't initially conceive of this as a chronological thing, in part because time was so kind of tweaked in those post-Katrina years anyway. It didn't feel like we were living in linear time necessarily for a while there. And I didn't really imagine that people would want to read this in one sitting from, you know, start to finish. So I initially had themes that I was looking at and that I was trying to kind of... So I was looking in a kind of focused way for things that were addressing, like insurance, for instance. That was such a tedious but critical part of people's recovery. So people who were writing about that, Michael Homan, who's blogging about making congressional testimony against Allstate. But then also music, the recovery of music. Also that the weird fall of 2005, what a strange time that was to be living in the city when there were no children in the city, because there
right,
were
right.
and there were no mothers, and so families were, it felt like living in Deadwood, you know, and so I was looking for things that really tapped into the things that I didn't want to forget, like the strangeness of that time, because we all kind of know the bullet points of Katrina and how that all happened and what happened, but really trying to get at what it felt like, that was kind of my criteria. And I worried that it would be too purple, you know, that it would be really raw and over the top. And I even had this kind of private joke with myself that my criteria was, you know, whether or not it actually did make me cry. But I think it's important to remember the intensity of that time, even if you don't necessarily want to relive it. But to remember, it's amazing how quickly you do forget. You go back, and so many of the people I communicated with when talking to them about becoming contributors to this, they would say, gosh, it feels like a dream, or it's so weird to go back and look at this. And you would think that you were talking to people about something that happened a half century ago.
Right, right.
It's amazing how 10 years is, it's a long time, but it's not that long.
And it's also amazing how, what emotional integrity this writing has, because it stood up for so long. I mean, and these small pieces really capture that kind of fierce, varied emotional climate of that time. And in many cases served as a corrective to national news and answered the basic questions people wanted to know, like, where is everybody? How's my house? What are we going to do next? You know, And I love that one blogger who said, CNN, could you just do a pass down Faubourg-Marigny? Right. Could you just show me my neighborhood, you know?
Right. That was Richard Reed, mm-hmm. is the blogger who wrote that. And that was such a sentiment at the time. There very much was this us versus them and, you know, this frustration of not being able to be in your city, and the only people who were able to be in your city were the ones who understood it the least, you know. And then that was such a difficult thing to sit there and watch, you know, to be sort of rendered passive during those first few days and weeks, I think, for people. And that's what I think was so empowering about being able to self-publish, you know, was to be able to say, you know what, I'm not just sitting here and passively watching. I can be a witness.
Yeah.
You know, I can actually be an active witness. And I think that's a really powerful kind of shift that takes place. And for me, too, I mean, I'd worked in national media years later. In a lot of ways, I really did feel like I entered the belly of the beast. I mean, I was working for a national network that was all about parachuting into situations and beaming back to you the ostensible truth of that situation. And, you know, a lot of those, I would say most of those journalists are well-intentioned and they want to get the story right. You know, and a lot of them probably are too arrogant to think that that is impossible to do. But just to be able to do that from Midtown Manhattan, you know, mm-hmm. that's kind of an impossible construct in this day and age. And that was another piece of it, too, that I was in the newsroom, you know, during the Arab Revolution and kind of watched how this tipping point for Twitter, you know, Twitter had been considered kind of this possibly just a flash in the pan, you know, not something that was to be taken seriously by mainstream media. And that was where the entire story of the Egypt Revolution took place. You know, Twitter was where that story happened. And a couple years after that, some researchers discovered, I think, like up to 40% of the material that was shared on that platform is actually gone. So that historical text, you know, that's no longer happening on the evening news. It's no longer happening in the daily newspapers. And where it's happening isn't necessarily being archived, or at least not in any easily accessible way. So that kind of triggered this idea for me. I was like, you know, Hurricane Katrina was really that same thing with regard to blogging. Mm-hmm. I think it was very much the same kind of moment. You know, you had the largest U.S. disaster, and then this moment where everybody kind of embraced this format, and it legitimized a lot of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, there's this wonderful passage that Chris DeBar wrote that I think I'll end with, because it shows how important it is that we preserve these things. And he's talking about a moment when he saw four magnificent frigate birds. And he writes, "Take this memory of mine and use it to see why it matters, why people should want Louisiana to be saved. Maybe it can now be a memory for you to share, you reading these words in your place and deciding to pass it on. Tell somebody today that Louisiana matters and convince them of that inalienable fact. If you can fit it in, use the word magnificent, referring to all of us down here who just want to keep doing what we do best because we mean to keep bringing it every day. Worth remembering? I hope so." And that's the way this book feels to me, you know, when you read it. It has that kind of impact on your heart, I think.
Yeah, I'm so pleased to hear that, because that is what I wanted to have, was an emotionally accurate account of the storm. There's so much written about Katrina, and there's so much material out there, but I still felt like I wasn't, with each anniversary that approached, I kind of had this sense of dread. And I think that sense of dread came in part from anticipating this kind of mandatory mourning around a rendition of the story that never quite felt true to me. And so I think I wanted to have kind of this document of what it felt like to me. It felt true.
It does. It's going to feel true to everybody who reads it, I think. We've been talking with Cynthia Joyce, who is the editor of Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina. You can meet her, along with some of the contributors to the book, Thursday, August 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Cynthia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It was a ghost town the day before the storm came. A haunting horn sound drifted past the Esplanade. The hallowed high ground hunkered down for the hurricane. Ooh, the levee fell down. fortune spared the view carrying. And we were singing, run, 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 river, run from the ugly. It's that same old saxophone ring and ring. And the golden heart of the city survived. St. Louis Cathedral, calm and blue sky. When you're living with the river, you know. Sing and run.
Tony Dunbar is a New Orleans lawyer and the creator of the Tubby DuVernay series, featuring, not surprisingly, a New Orleans lawyer who has a penchant for troublesome cases. I love this series. I love the way Tubby takes long lunches, imbibes generously. I love his brilliant assistant, Cherry Lynn. And now Tubby's back, troubling the waters of the past with the 8th entry in the series, The Night Watchman. Tony Dunbar, so good to have you on The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
So it's been a while since Tubby's been in action, you know?
Yeah, the last book was Tubby Meets Katrina, which was just, I guess, something I had to write for my mental health. But, you know, I took a few years to come out of Katrina and then sort of put Tubby aside for a while. But then with Books Be Nimble here, the publisher here in New Orleans, we began bringing them out in digital format, the original six, which also took a couple of years to do. And, man, those guys sell just phenomenally well. And that sort of re-inspired me to write something again because, gosh, there was a, you know, there's an audience out there, there was readers again.
Yeah. So Tubby's had a very long vacation, which he is enjoying on the very first page of this book.
That's right. The book begins where he's visiting a girlfriend from the past, Marguerite, who was in an earlier book, in Florida, and sort of sousing himself on the patio and soaking up the heat and wondering how he can survive in such an aura of perfection. And while there, begins to reflect on his youth in New Orleans, and suddenly he's overcome both by a desire to get back to New Orleans and also to begin to look into an old shooting that he witnessed as a teenager.
Just can't keep away. Just, I love right. that. It's just right. like, things are too perfect, so we'll go back.
Go back to New Orleans. Well, New Orleans is perfect, too, in many ways. I mean, this is a magnificent city. Just, you know, visually, the great skyline, the majestic bridges, all of our neighborhoods are so colorful.
Yeah.
The warehouse district smells like wet bricks. I mean, you know, above and beyond all the, you know, the other cool things about living here. It's really, you know, the only city that matters.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the case from the past. I mean, you can see that Tubby would be traumatized by this experience.
Well, he visited New Orleans as a about a 19-year-old in the 70s, aspiring to transfer to Tulane, and kind of across paths with the part of the world that he had previously not experienced, which were the street people living in the city. And New Orleans was really a very different time back then. I mean, there was certainly mirth and gaiety and good food. But, you know, in the 60s and 70s, we were coming out of segregation. There were still battles on desegregation, quite ferocious ones. And the Vietnam War was going on. Police chief sent the armored car into the projects to try to roust out the Black Panthers, the shootout at Desire. There was a lot of division and it was just a different world in New Orleans back then. Well, anyway, Tubby happened to drop into this briefly and also drop into a street demonstration where he saw another kid killed by a passing vehicle and never really did anything about it, but it bothered him for years. And now in the contemporary time, sitting on the porch in Florida, it sort of trips in his mind and he wonders, whatever happened to that? Did anybody ever get prosecuted? Who was that kid? And so that's the sort of the theme of the book.
That's interesting. What is it about New Orleans that just, you know, feeds these conspiracy theories?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think we were very much part of the times in the period that I began the book in, but also as a Southern, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, but I think New Orleans has always kind of been a leader in odd people being here, odd conspiracies formulating here.
Yeah.
You know, Lee Harvey Oswald lived here, and then, you know, we had a district attorney who had a lengthy trial claiming that, you know, the whole Kennedy assassination had been plotted here. This book talks about a totally imaginary group of Latin people here in New Orleans who for decades had, you know, contributed to the, you know, violence of our city. That's a completely made up group of people, but it seems to fit naturally into the New Orleans fabric.
It does.
Where it's very
it
easy
really
to
does.
Yeah, it's very easy to imagine conspiratorial forces of all sorts here.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the serious underpinnings of this book, I think, spring from your long writing about politics and society and change in the South. I mean, we met, I recall, when your book Delta Time was published. So you've been looking at the changing South for a long time.
I have written books about Southern history, civil rights, and it's gratifying that some of those books are still significant, at least to historians. Frankly, living in the South, that's an area of great interest to me, the changes that I've witnessed and the history that I have touched. But other than the gratification, none of those books has ever achieved any kind of readership anywhere close to the fiction.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think it's very important for me to have readers. You know, I use the books to get things off my chest, but I'm trying to lay it on somebody else.
And so, that's so true.
So you want to have somebody out there, you know, to interact with. And I've enjoyed the nonfiction because it's always been an education. I've always written about things in response to wanting to learn about them myself. But the flip side of that is the Tubby Dubinet books have, you know, reached a lot of people. And mm-hmm. I think I can really say almost everything I need to say through the medium of Tubby Dubinet.
Right. He's such a fine alter ego. I mean.
Yeah, well, okay.
A bit. Yeah. Just a bit.
Just a bit.
So does this mean that he'll be appearing with more regularity now? Are you working on another one yet?
I hope so. I'm not working on another one yet. This just came out in June. And the paperback version of it just came out about 3 weeks ago. So we'll see how this does for a while. But, yeah, it's all on me. You know, I've got another career life as an attorney here in New Orleans. So writing is still a spare time kind of an occupation. But it's very important for me to do it. I mean, it keeps me out of therapy. I can eliminate evil and cap it off with justice at the end, which is very very gratifying to many of us to be able to do. Kind of parallels my legal work, too, which is not quite as clear-cut as the fiction, but I enjoy the engagement with opposing counsel, and I enjoy bringing cases to a conclusion, hopefully fairly. So the two work together. Yeah, I'm looking around. I try to do something contemporary in these books. I mean, this book has issues like the music ordinance, live music ordinance. That plays a role in here, and off-duty police details, that plays a role in here. And those are kind of New Orleans issues. And, you know, Tubby leaves Uptown and goes out to Bywater and St. Claude, which are new areas to me and, you know, part of a big new, I won't say rebirth, but a redevelopment, regrowing of a whole section of the city, but very exciting. So as new things appear to me, that kind of spurs on another book.
That's right. There's a little bit of New Orleans past, present, and future in this book. It's really interesting. I know. It's not often you come across comprehensive zoning ordinance and murder mystery and kind of perk up and go, I know what that is.
It is sort of a leap that somebody would be interested in. I try to make it interesting.
You made it fun. You made it a lot of fun. So I'm glad Tubby's percolating again and perambulating around the city.
Thank you.
We've been talking with New Orleans lawyer Tony Dunbar, whose new book in the Tubby Dubinet series is The Night Watchman. Tony, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Fatima Sheikh signs What Went Missing and What Got Found, Tuesday, August 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Cynthia Joyce, appears at a launch party for Please Forward, How Blogging Reconnected New Orleans After Katrina. That's Tuesday, August 18th at 6 at the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude. Joyce also appears with bloggers Deborah Cotton, Bart Everson, and Michael Homan to sign Please Forward Thursday, August 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. You can also see her at Rising Tide, a conference on the future of New Orleans, during the 10th annual gathering at Xavier University. Featured writers include Joyce, Bob Marshall, Gary Rivlin, Rebecca Thieme, and a special presentation by the Melanated Writers Collective. Check out risingtidenola.com for more info. Photojournalist Leon Morris signs Homage, New Orleans, Wednesday, August 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. Roberta Brandis-Gratz signs We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City, Thursday, August 20th at 6:30 at All Souls Episcopal Church, 5500 St. Claude Avenue in Holy Cross, and again Tuesday, August 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kurt Amaker, author of Immortal 60, The Collection, discusses comics and the art of writing graphic novels, Thursday, August 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The New Orleans Museum of Art continues its arts and letters programming, accompanying the Katrina exhibit 10 Years Gone. Richard Campanella, author of Bienville's Dilemma and New Orleans, Urban Fabrics Before the Storm, appears Friday, August 21st at 7:30 in an interview with me. Please join us. Judy Walker signs Cooking Up a Storm, Recipes Lost and Found from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Saturday, August 22nd from 8:30 to 10:30 at the Crescent City Farmers Market, and again from 2 to 4 at Kitchen Witch, 631 Toulouse Street. C. Carter Frank signs The Adventurous NOLA Kids Go to the Ruined Mansion, Saturday, August 22nd at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. The New Orleans Jane Austen Society is sponsoring Jane for a Day, Sunday, August 23rd from 1 to 4 at the Beauregard Kai's House, 1113 Charter Street in the French Quarter. Ever wanted to live like the characters in Austen's novels? Now you can. There will be performances by the La Louisiane Vintage Dancers and Aaron Fannin's The Singing Austen, a vocal performance of parlor songs of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, with selections from Haydn, Mozart, and Schubert. Guests are invited to tour the home and grounds, enjoy refreshments, and an All Things Jane pop-up shop. Tickets are available at the door. Don Brown signs Ruined City, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Sunday, August 23rd from 2 to 3 at Octavia Books. Poets Jimmy Ross and Laura Mattingly read from their work, Sunday, August 23rd at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Eleanor Bonney signs her novel, Landfall, Monday, August 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Blaine Lord signs his memoir, Born on the Bayou, Tuesday, August 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.